Thank you, everybody, for today. I see the red dot. It's ominous. And I'm squiggling. Okay. As long as the squiggles are there, we know we're being recorded. Thank you all for coming today. Those of you who have sat all day, thank you. And those of you who've shown up for this little chat, thank you. My two young friends and their mom. Mm-hmm. I didn't bring my wand today. I thought I'd chat a little bit about the form of Dokusan, which is, I think, so different from much of what goes on in our life when we have a conversation with someone. In the most formal, you know, you sort of sit outside in the hallway, and bell's rung, and you go in, and the Roshi is sitting right in front of the Buddha. And the Zabuton you're going to sit on is right in front of the Roshi, about here. And you bow at the door, and you close the door, and then you walk up to the back of the Zabuton. And you do three prostrations right to the Roshi. And then you arrange yourself and are seated. And then you express yourself as you feel needs be. And there may be some response or not. And then after some interchange, the bell's rung, you get up and you do prostrations. You back up to the door. You don't turn your back on the Roshi. And you do a standing bow, and then you slip out the door. A lot of people are concerned about things like, why am I bowing to this guy? Who does he think he is?
Or a woman.
Or a woman, yeah, yeah. This person. And is that guy a guy? Is that woman a woman? Who's Buddha? Most of us in our lives, we have no idea where we are. We have no idea where we're standing. We have no idea what we're approaching. We have no sense of exactly where we're standing. So here there's some form. You open the door, you close the door, you bow, you walk four steps forward. Now, if you are someone who's like an ordained monk, you've got paraphernalia. You've got your robes and your okesa, and you have your zago. Unfurl your zagu, making sure not to do it in front of the Buddha, to the side, and then you put it down, and you fold it, and then you go through all this rigmarole of bowing, and getting up, and then you actually sit on the zangu, on the zabuton. And then maybe you have the temerity to think you're going to say something. By which time the bell is already rung. And you're getting back up. And you're doing three more bows. And you're leaving. Um, But we don't do it that formally here, obviously. And I think some people confused, some of the people who are sitting in front of the Buddha confused who they were with the Buddha. And which then confused the people who are sitting in front of them. And we don't beat people with sticks anymore. Some people got carried away with that. Kind of wild. Strange. But really, the issue here is to make clear to ourselves that we're entering a space, that we're going to meet someone or something, and this may well be ourself. And we're going to bow. And what are we bowing to? I mean, how can I bow to that person? He's not better than me. Why am I so resistant to this bowing? I'm not going to bow. And all this while, bowing. It's a little bit like our resistance to taking care of our kids. I'm not going to take care of them. They always want so much. You guys, you want so much. I'm the adult here. Yeah. Who do you think you are? Or our spouse. What is this resistance? And what is it that allows us to follow through? Or to leave? To run away? Oh, that's a bad run away. So, what is it that brings us to the point where we can face and be present to our resistance? To actually viscerally experience our resistance of what we think we are. The resistance that comes out of our not knowing who we are and where we are and what we actually have to say that has any relevance to our life. So we stylize this. It's very formal for us in our modern day, because usually, you know, we walk in, we say, "Hi, how you doing? Want some coffee? Well, this is going on, and that's going on. I don't know who I am, but, geez, you know, it's all okay." This is not about that. I mean, that may transpire. But the form lets us know that there's something else that's required of our presence here on earth. It pins us down a bit. It at least shows us our resistance. And there's a difference between a person who comes in and disregards form but doesn't do it in a way that is against or out of fear, that does it as, "Oh, I see this form. And I'm comfortable with this form, and to hell with it at the same time." And then the more Soto approach, his Soto Zen approach, is never even to have to do that. To just come in and bow and get up and leave. So the framing is incredibly important, because when we walk into the room to speak with our children, when we walk into the room to speak with our parents, when we walk into the room to speak with our elderly mother or our spouse, do we know where we are? Do we know who we are? Do we know what we have to say? So that's the question, and that's the form. In our society, we don't, in the modern culture, we don't have a way pointing that out. We're all pretty uncouth. But that's why this form is so important for us. We have to go in there and we sit there, we're eye to eye with someone, and it's a totally unfamiliar thing, and our knees hurt, our back hurts, and our life sucks. And are we going to say something wise? You know? Are we going to say something Zen? Are we going to touch ourselves? So that's Dokusan. And I know, I don't know that I've ever spoken about it. But the form of it is quite important. For all the reasons that we think it's not. Because most everything else we have to say is, as I said in class the other day, in reference to one person's confusion, is bullshit. One of my favorite little quotes is from a friend of mine. She worked with a Korean Zen teacher whose name I can't remember in Korea. And he said, you know, you can fool most people. And if you're really, really good, you can fool me. But you can never fool yourself. So that Buddha and that person sitting in front of the Buddha, your bowing, our bowing, is ourself. The self we can never fool. And it's our opportunity to meet that self. So lately we've been studying Norman Fisher's book, Training the Mind in Compassion, Zen Commentaries on Lojong, and we're in the four preliminaries. And it's interesting because right in that Dokusan encounter is the rareness and preciousness of life. The indelible
inevitability of death.
Of death. And what about our actions?
The awesome and indelible power
of our actions. And four?
Inescapability of suffering.
The inescapability of suffering. So lately I've been, I picked up two books that are interrelated with D.T. Suzuki. D.T. Suzuki is like maybe the first big Zen translator and importer in the West. And I've been reading a little bit about his seminars at Columbia and the people who went there between 1953 and 64. One of whom was a man named John Cage, who's a musician, amongst other things. So John has this to say. I have a number of quotes from John. Most music tries to control its circumstances, just as most of us do. So when we walk into the Dokusan room, we're not necessarily in control. We're in a strange land. But what is this control that we're not in of? But there's another way to live. Accept indeterminacy as a principle, and you see your life in a new light, as a series of seemingly unrelated, jewel-like stories within a dazzling setting of change and transformation. What's that? Something about dreams?
Mm-hmm.
See life as a dream?
See everything
as a dream. Mm-hmm. Recognizing that you don't know where you stand, back in the Dokusan room, recognizing that you don't know where you stand, and you will begin to watch where you put your feet. What do I do when I walk in the door? Do I walk over here? How do I walk? That's when the path appears. So the whole story here, this will probably sound crazy to you, but when I stand up at the back of that Zabudon, I have no idea where I'm going. I'm standing at the back of the Zabudon. And then I walk. Then I get to the altar. And the altar tells me what to do. And then I do it as completely as I can right there with the altar, with the incense, with the soam. And then I walk back. And then it's that next thing. I do it. Bow, get up. Bow, get up. Bow, get up. I've done it so many times, but the point of it is that it's just right there. It's totally indeterminate, but you're completely there with it. And at that moment, anything could happen. Do you remember that time in Sesshin when Tom was going to hit the bell?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And I dashed over from the Zabudon. I'm sorry, Tom.
Twice. You didn't.
Twice.
But who's counting?
Don't strike that bell. Once, I used to be a sailor, a pretty experienced sailor, and I took somebody sailing, and it was only the two of us on the boat, and sailing and doing, you know, just doing my normal stuff about knowing how to sail. And afterwards, he said he was impressed with how quickly I moved. But it's like you don't move. It only looks quick if you don't know what's going on. Because everything's telling you what to do. But just like, and Daniel said to me, he said, I didn't know you could move that fast when I moved over.
Yes.
Because you were going so slow. But it's each moment. And the more powerfully we are able to forget the antecedent and the procedent, I don't know, that which follows, that's to come, the more powerful it is. It takes everybody into it. And then everybody's feeling that in unison. So this is John Cage on a man named Mark Tobey. Mark was a painter. An abstract expressionist who went to Japan in the 20s and Paris in the 30s. And would you like a chair?
No, that's good.
Okay. He actually spent a little bit of time at a monastery, I think a month or two. And was deeply affected by that experience. So John Cage goes, and though I love the work of Morris Graves, who was a friend of John's and also a friend of Mark Tobey's, and sometimes considered a student of Mark Tobey's, and still do, it was Mark Tobey who had a great effect on my way of seeing. Which is to say, my involvement with painting or my involvement with life itself. So these things we do together, like these rituals, or like serving tea in a sesshin, or like sewing a rakusu together. The tedium and the resistance to them, and the opening. The opening to resistance, the opening to seeing something new. So Mark said to me, look at everything. Don't close your eyes to the world around you. That's why we sit with our eyes open. Look and become curious and interested in what there is to see. I remember in particular a walk with Mark from the area of Seattle around the Cornish School, down the hill and through the town toward a Japanese restaurant. A walk that would not normally take more than 45 minutes, but on this occasion it must have taken several hours. Because he was constantly stopping and pointing out things to see. Opening my eyes, in other words, which, if I understand it at all, has been a function of 20th century art, to open our eyes, just seeing what there was and is to see. You look at that conifer, for instance, and because it all looks basically alike, like other trees, you say, it's a tree. And when you say that, you cease to look. Oh, that's just my mother. That's just my husband. That's just John. But only if you move from understanding to actually experience can you really begin to see. This is the whole Zen thing is a contraption. It's like a maze that we go through, or a labyrinth that brings us to see, to experience. That's what the form is. Otherwise, we don't see. The tree that we think we see and have categorized is a dream. It's not the actual tree. So when we see all things as a dream, we're questioning the world that we've set up in our categories. We're letting go of that. And maybe, like the Zen story that says some guy like, you know, one of those likelies like Zhao Zhou or so on is walking around with a government minister and he says, "See those flowers? Like men in a dream." Because who sees? Who's with the flowers? The more closely attention is given, the more difficult it becomes to fix something by name or by relation to other things. It begins to move on into another being. So I think with all of us, you know, our first falling in love is that dissolution of ourself with another. And a large part of our experience is returning to that innocence. Blake, Songs of Experience and Songs of Innocence. But it's like a second innocence, and if I remember correctly, the etymology of innocence has to do with innocere, something about not harming. And on a certain level, by believing the reality of our categorization of people and things, we're harming. We're separating things from us and the context. We're establishing a causality, a direct chain of causality that may, shall we say, serve purposes that are not very helpful to life. So we're paying attention. And he's now talking about a painting of Mark Tobey's that he couldn't afford, that he bought. And he did it a little bit of abstract expressionist art history in New York City. He bought it through the Willard Gallery on 70th and Madison Avenue, I think it was, or 72nd and Madison Avenue, where Morris Graves, Mark Tobey, various other different types of abstract expressionists from the de Koonings and so on of the world showed. But and he bought it on the layaway plan. He gave her $100 a month for some long period of time. And then he goes, I've since unfortunately sold it. It was a painting which had no representation in it at all. It was a canvas that had been utterly painted. But it had not been painted in a way that would suggest the geometrical abstraction that interested me. So it brought about a change in me. So back to Dokusan. That's a geometrical abstraction that doesn't meet your requirements. That may bring a change about. That we're resistant to. And also, that walk to the Japanese restaurant brought about a change in my eyes. And into my relationship to art, such that when I left the Willard Gallery, Toby exhibited, I was standing at a corner on Madison Avenue, waiting for a bus. And I happened to look at the pavement. And I noticed that the experience of looking at the pavement was the same as the experience of looking at the Toby. Exactly the same. The aesthetic enjoyment was just as high. So, you have a change in my view. So sometimes when we, you know, sit here for a few zazen periods, more often when we sit here for a few days, then we walk outside, we notice our relationship with the ground, the grass and the pavement. It's a little different. The categories, the generalities of tree have changed. I'm with this particular, we'll call it a bush. But there's this leaf. You know, there's that strange stuff they call mulch that they put down. But it's this particular mulch. It's this particular moment. It's this particular breath. It's this particular glistening frost. Or cold air. So we open to this particular and not this general. And then we do each particular what you have in the case of Toby and the case of pavement. And then a case, what you have is the case of Toby and in the case of pavement, and then a case of much abstract expressionism, is a surface which in no sense has a center of interest. So that it is truly distinguished from most art, Occidental and Oriental, that we know of. The individual is able to look at first one part, and then another. And insofar as he can to experience the whole. But the whole is such a whole that it doesn't look as if the frame frames it. So it looks as if that sort of thing could have continued beyond the frame. Beyond treeness. Beyond conifer. Beyond John. Beyond resistance. Trying to remember more closely, but Dick Baker used to say, when you look into someone's eyes, Do not be afraid of seeing the Grand Canyon. So that's also Dokusan. But that changes our view. That's what we take to all of life. So it requires something that they say about John Cage here. How's it go? This is the biographer speaking. Cage's own life, hardly immune from controversy even now, offers an object lesson. He learned very early to ignore criticism, since he knew perfectly well his work was not ridiculous. Criticism was of no interest, nor was praise, which seemed to require that he repeat himself. At every point, society acts to keep us from doing what we have to do, he said in 1973. From the outset, he set off to find his own answers, and he looked to experimentalists for precedents. The point here is don't sell your inmost request short. Don't allow resistance and ambivalence to deter us from fulfilling our deepest desire and finding out what it is. Don't harm people in the process. But a part of this is latching on to something and not letting go. It's taking one of these slogans and having it cut right through our life. Everything. Just trying it on. So, in some ways, this is what Jukai does. So we sew, we study the precepts, we get nervous, we get resistant, we fall in love with it, we think it's going to be great, and then we're totally frightened of it, and then we want to delimit it, but it's outside the frame. And it's that much more so for our friends who are going to be, are planning to be ordained as priests. So they'll need your help. But we all need one another's help. That's why we do Jukai. And that's why we do priest ordination. It calls us forth. And I guess Heidegger used to talk about the peal of the bell. We can hear it calling us. So the introductory poem to the Blue Cliff Records, translated by Tom Cleary, talks about these flowers, and this guy walking around a city. It goes, knock on any door, someone will be sure to respond. So it's the willingness to knock on doors, or on doors, doors in Dokusan. the willingness to have no end in sight. To just enter the ceremony of interrelationship and allow whatever is to be revealed. And that's like Dokusan as well. Don't worry about not knowing what to say. Don't make some baloney up. Don't carry it around with you. The situation, it's like Shosan ceremony, right? You can plan your poem. You can memorize it. And you get up there. Where the hell did that come from? And this is important. Because that indeterminacy opens everyone. And the willingness to be present to it is so powerful that it changes our way of seeing. Norman politely refers to visceral experience. Someplace in the introduction they're talking about you might be a nice person or a kind person or something like this. And then he said, but this isn't based on trying to be a nice person. This is the result of a visceral experience. You know, this is the result of the roiling of our guts and the loss of control. This is visceral. This is reverse peristalsis. You know, this is, and that's okay. And where in society do we? Do we have this opportunity? In this quiet little space, silently in the Zendo. Who would know? Philip Whalen has a little poem, four phrases. I didn't try, but I thought of trying to look for it. His collected poetry was on Tom's desk last night where I spent the night. But... goes something like this, you know. Well, anyway, you're sitting in the Zendo with everybody, and no one, everybody's having some experience. And this one guy Philip's describing is like, who knew that he was going to explode? You know? Just sitting there. We're so tight. I mean, even if we can do yoga, we're so tight. Our guts are so tight around our central column. Made me think of Judy Dench. Anyway, we're clenched. Or we're clenched. Okay.
That's a funny one.
But you know, we I think, what was the title of one of Norman's book of poetry? Opening to You. So this is what we're doing. We're opening. I don't know what that means. So thank you. Okay. No. May our intentions equally extend to every
being. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Now, if we were in a real Zendo, we would get up and we'd do three more bows. See this? My right leg wakes up. Just do a standing bow here like everybody at the end, and then we would collect ourselves. Then I would take one step back, put my hands in my shoulder, and then I would take another step back and bow in shashu and would ring another bell, and then I would turn and depart. And as soon as I walked out of the zendo, you would hit two bells.
Huh?
Yep. Well done.
Well done for you too.
And, and let's not forget Donna.
Yes. And we have to clean up.
Yeah, we have to clean up. Put our chairs back.